Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Season 2, Issue 11 of the Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. This issue, the world's last wonder chapters 11 and 12, with allusions to colonial invasions and further references to the constant disagreement between socialists and capitalists. Science-wise, there's a comparison between the sun's glare on Mars compared to Earth, and that the Martian atmosphere is less dense. We are also treated to a version of the other in the form of two gigantic spiders, as well as a first contact situation with humanoids who don't speak, for reasons that will become clear in the narrative.
Chapter 11. A Broken Banner. The Pioneer was still signalling without getting any answering sign back from the Martian city when suddenly a violent flashing leapt at us, so to speak, and the annexator flew past, throwing out rapid coruscations of light as a frightened bird emits screams in hasty succession. It was a frantic call to us to follow, and we did, signalling as soon as we could to learn what was the matter. Then we ascertained that Arcturus G. Fisher and Sir Mark Solomon were the only occupants of the companion car. The rest of the party had been left behind on the Martian ground, abandoned to meet a danger from which Fisher and Solomon had precipitately fled. Putting together the confused messages that we then received and what we learned later, the annexator had descended and been anchored on a tract of what was judged to be waste country, as those on board were desirous of stretching their legs after the long confinement of the journey. They spent a day in this relaxation without anything in particular happening, keeping at first very near to the car, which had emitted no signals, and had probably been as yet entirely unperceived by any of the planet's inhabitants. The next morning, they gradually gained confidence to wander further. At least Drought and Dazzler did so, taking Alice with them. But Fisher and Solomon remained in the vicinity of the annexator, where they occupied themselves in the amusement of setting up a banner and preparing to take formal possession of the planet in the name of their syndicate. It was intended to complete the ceremony when the rest of the party returned for refreshments. It was at this time that the Pioneer approached, keeping high in the air, and in spite of its being daytime, commenced to signal. It is to be remembered that the sun's glare is far less at Mars than at the Earth, and also the Martian atmosphere is less dense, so that the flash signaling by day was at a great advantage, so compared with what it would have been on Earth. But the truth is that after being for so long used to the conditions of outer space, we did not think about day and night. Upon perceiving us, Fisher and Solomon were anxious to hurry on the ceremony of taking possession, so as to get it over before we could come to the ground. They therefore beckoned to the others, and themselves retired towards the annexator for the purpose of bringing out a bottle of wine. They were just coming away again, carrying the wine to where the banner was erected, when suddenly two gigantic spiders, with bodies larger than the bodies of fat oxen, appeared, they knew not whence. One of which reached out a long limb, contemptuously snapped the pole asunder, and deliberately rolling the banner up, put it in his pocket, for the strange animal was arrayed in a spun garment of massive cobweb. This was quite enough for the two millionaires, who in the presence of greater spiders than themselves, expected nothing but to be pounced on and sucked as dry, physically, as they had sucked everyone they could financially. They fled into the car and set it mounting for their lives, leaving Dazzler, Drought and Alice Beston to their fate, but signaled to us in passing from that instinct which often impels fugitives to seek company as a possible means to their own greater safety. The moment that we understood this, we started the Pioneer for the spot from which the annexator had just risen, but Fisher and Solomon were too terrified to return even in our company, for which we were not sorry. We scanned the ground below with emotions that I need not attempt to describe, and to our great relief found Alice Beston, along with the two scientists, safe and sound. The meeting that took place between Alice Beston and Fred Riva was left to themselves whilst we cornered the scientists, for as yet it must be borne in mind that we supposed them privy to the girl's abduction by Fisher. But a few words explained matters to our satisfaction. As to the spiders, the party had seen them and were quite sure of having been seen by them. However, the creatures had passed by quite indifferently, precisely as if Earth people were the most commonplace of sights to them. We took the derelict party up into the Pioneer and, returning to our former station, resumed signalling towards the city, from which we were rewarded after sunset by seeing at length the flash of answering lights, which seemed to beckon us sideways. The car was made to respond, and in compliance with further apparent beckonings, its position was again shifted several times. The signalling from the inhabitants then ceased for hours, except for mere stationary flashes, which were repeated at short intervals. This somewhat mystified us. But shortly before the return of dawn, there was a vigorous illumination over the whole city, and after we had made a display in return, the revolving lights worked again. We moved the Pioneer round to the quarter at which the rays halted, and thereupon received an unmistakable signal inviting us to descend. Chapter 12. The Pioneer touched the ground as the new day dawned, and we emerged from the car to await our welcomers. After a little while, we saw a party approaching. They seemed to be men, and this, we said as we waited for them to come up, no doubt accounted for the indifference displayed by the giant spiders, which had probably learned by experience that such beings were best let alone. We did not yet know everything. What struck me at the time as remarkable was the solemn silence in which these people, if people they were, advanced towards us, and which they maintained when they arrived. Upon this taking place, one of them, who seemed to be the most venturesome of the party, came a little nearer than the rest, and pointing to us and then to the car, gave us to understand by a gesture that he was fain to know whence we had come. In reply to this, I pointed to the heavens, where our earth still shone visibly through the morning's radiance. He looked at me with a curious stare, and seemed either to be incredulous or not to understand. At this, happening to have in my pocket a chart of the solar system, I took it out, and whilst even Apollo and Dazzler hung back in stupefaction, advanced with it to the Martian, holding it out so that he could see it plainly. He allowed me to come quite close to him, and I pointed first to the sun, then to its place on the chart, next to the earth and its place, and finally to the soil beneath us, upon which, to my pleasure, he placed a finger upon the spot at which Mars was indicated on the chart. Then, pointing to the car, I showed again the earth on the chart, and slowly traced a line thence to the representation of Mars. He still kept a solid silence. We wore close-fitting cloth caps with four peaks, and at the first glance it appeared that all the Martians wore the like. This seems irrelevant, but it is not. I had had my eyes turned upon the chart whilst pointing. As I finished, I lifted them to look at the silent Martian's face, and this is what I saw. What I had taken for the peak of a cap was a flap of skin, attached to the sides of a long proboscis, the taper end of which had been coiled up beneath it. The Martian had uncoiled this organ and was stretching it out towards my forehead. At that moment he reminded me of nothing so much as a gigantic mosquito putting forth its snout to sting, and I jumped back in alarm so suddenly that my cap came off and fell on the ground. At this, the Martian leapt back too, evidently yet more alarmed than I had been, but his fright somewhat reassuring me, I advanced again, picked up the cap, and replaced it on my head. I then saw him turn to one of the other Martians, extending his proboscis as he had done to me, whereupon the other unrolled a similar organ from the flip of his forehead, and the two touched the ends of their proboscis together. At once the meaning of it dawned upon me. These people, much as they outwardly resembled us at a merely casual view, were of an insect affinity, and the proboscis which had so alarmed me was not a sting, but a modification of the antennae or feelers with which we are accustomed to see ants, for instance, converse together. Plainly, what the two Martians were doing with their proboscis was talking, and the action which had set me in a fright was nothing else than an attempt to open a conversation. This explained the silence. It was no wonder. But here was a new difficulty. We were not possessed of any such organs. The contact of Martian antennae was not likely to convey any meaning to us, and probably our own mode of language would be just as unnatural to them. This would necessitate the restriction of all intercommunication to gesticulations and written symbols, and would inevitably make conversation as far as it could be carried on a very lengthy process. Resolved that if Apollo had the credit of inventing the radio motor, and Dazzler that of enabling two cars to connect their interiors in the vacuum of space, I would not fall short of the honor of being first to succeed in establishing effectual intercourse with the inhabitants of the planet onto which we had ventured, I made a further attempt. Showing the Martian my cap, which I took off, and passing my hand over my bare forehead, I demonstrated to him that I was not possessed of a proboscis. I then pointed to myself and said, "Man," and to a stone and said, "Stone." But as I expected, he gave no evidence whatever of being conscious that I had spoken. He had seen my mouth move, for he made a puzzled effort to imitate the movement with his own, and his companion, evidently putting a different interpretation on my action, took from a packet some sort of food off which he broke a piece, ate that, and handed the remainder to me. I accepted it, but put it aside, and taking a piece of paper and a pencil, pointed to myself and wrote, "Man," and to the stone, and wrote, "Stone." They seemed at first to be about to understand my meaning, but when they glanced at the paper, an obvious expression of despair came over their features. Then the one who had first advanced took the pencil and paper, and pointing to me, drew a rough figure of a man. I began to realize now his difficulty, so pointing to myself, to his picture, and to my written word, I endeavored to convey to him that the two latter had the same meaning. But although he seemed at length to understand, I could not get him to write down any symbol for me himself or any object. In every instance, he merely drew a picture. He kept pointing to his proboscis and to my blank and unadorned forehead, in a manner which caused me to believe that his people had, in the place of written language, some substitute depending on the faculties of the proboscis and unintelligible to anyone not thus provided. This was really the case, for I observed a member of the Martian party just then apply his proboscis to a little box, which I was allowed to examine, and I found that it contained a mechanism very much on the principle of a phonograph. Only, instead of recording sound, it recorded, I could not doubt, some nervous vibrations set up in the extremity of the proboscis, so that the same organ of the body served for conversation, for writing, and for reading. Reduced to a sense of the impossibility of ever conversing with the Martians except by the rudimentary means of gestures and pictures, I began to think that very little knowledge could be imparted, even after a long familiarity, by us to them, or by them to us. Therefore, resigning for the time the effort to communicate further, I turned my attention to the food, which, whilst of a kind new to me, was not unpalatable. All took the cue. The Martians opened their packages we brought out from the car, and the two races picnicked together, tasting for the first time in the history of the universe each other's food, the productions of worlds that millions of miles separated being assembled together at the eventful banquet. Of which I have only to say for the present that there was one special inequality, for the Martians quenched their thirst with salt water, more saline and mineralized than of our seas, and of this, to their surprise, we could not partake.
Wasn't that amazing? What I found incredible was the entire first contact scene. The humanoid wants to communicate, so lifts a flap of skin on his head, under which is a proboscis-like tube that shoots towards the head of the narrator, like a mosquito wanting blood. This difference is alarming to the narrator, but he recovers quickly when he understands its meaning, that the tube is an antennae that they use to communicate. This shock of a completely alien situation, the recovery, understanding, and adaptation is interesting as the narrator explains every point of his emotional journey and reasoning to be able to talk with the Martians. It shows a level of maturity and inquiry, and is a good example for first contact situations of the need to always retain composure. In any case, let's chat with Lucy about these chapters. Early science fiction often gets dismissed as pure fantasy, but here's something mind-blowing. This 1901 Mars story correctly described the planet's thin atmosphere decades before we had the technology to confirm it.
That's fascinating. And what really stands out is how this story isn't just about scientific accuracy. It's a clever social commentary. Wrapped in a space adventure, the author creates these two distinct groups: pioneers representing socialism and exploration, versus annexators representing capitalism and colonization.
You know what's really interesting about the political messaging? The author wasn't trying to be subtle at all. Those millionaire characters literally abandon their own people on the Martian surface at the first sign of danger. Talk about a pointed criticism of the wealthy elite.
And that line comparing the alien spiders to the way the millionaires financially drained people back on Earth, well, that's some pretty sharp commentary for early sci-fi.
The whole approach to the spider creatures is actually quite sophisticated. Instead of going for cheap thrills, these massive spider-like beings just completely ignore the humans. It's like, suddenly humanity isn't the centre of the universe anymore.
That detail about the spider alien rolling up the colonizer's banner and tucking it into its web pocket really stuck with me. Like they're just cleaning up after some primitive species.
So it completely flips the usual colonial narrative on its head, right? Instead of Europeans encountering primitive peoples, we have humans being treated as the primitive ones. And then there's that first contact scene with the humanoid Martians. It's probably one of the most realistic depictions I've seen from this era.
Oh my goodness, yes. Especially that terrifying moment with the antenna proboscis thing. Like, imagine someone suddenly extending a tube from under their skin toward your head.
Well, that's exactly what makes the narrator such an interesting character. The way he walks us through his thought process, from that initial panic to scientific curiosity. It's actually a pretty good model for handling cross-cultural encounters, even today.
The author really thought through the implications of truly alien communication, didn't they? The fact that they use vibrations instead of spoken language feels so ahead of its time.
You know what's really wild? Looking at modern first contact stories like Arrival, you can see how groundbreaking this was. Though I have to say, and this is where it gets a bit shaky, that food sharing scene seems like a stretch. Like, they can eat alien food but can't drink the water?
Well, some scientists have suggested it could make sense with the panspermia theory. You know, if life was transferred between planets via meteorites. But yeah, it's still pretty optimistic.
The way this story balances hard scientific facts with symbolic and social elements is really remarkable. It's not just about the technology or the aliens, it's about human nature and society. And the author manages to weave together accurate scientific details about Mars with this profound social commentary about colonialism and capitalism.
That's exactly why it feels so modern. These themes about exploration versus exploitation are still incredibly relevant today.
And let's talk about how the author subverts typical alien encounter tropes, even though those tropes hadn't really been established yet. The indifferent aliens, the genuine communication difficulties, it's all incredibly forward-thinking.
It reminds me of Stanislaw Lem's later works, that serious attempt to imagine truly different forms of intelligence.
Looking toward these final chapters, I'm particularly interested in how the author resolves all these threads. The political commentary, the communication challenges, and the broader themes about human nature. Given how sophisticated the story has been so far, I'm betting the conclusion will be equally thought-provoking. Thank you, Lucy. Next issue, the final chapters and the last issue of Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast for Season 2. Season 3 will return later in the year. Just a reminder, if you'd like to support the Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast, check out some of the stories written or edited by Neil A. Hogan on Amazon. Thank you for listening.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.